the Cinephile Hissy Fit Podcast, brought to you by the Ruminations Radio Network and sponsored by Film Obsessive. This is the tirade-filled movie debate hosted by two film critics, cool dads, and struggling teachers. I'm Don Shanahan.
And I'm too dumb or stupid to have fun, William Johnson.
There we go. The deep cut line for the movie that's coming out today here a little bit. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're damn glad to have you folks. This is all for tantrum's sake. We're shared passions and high fives wash away any place for hate. No matter what, we encourage you all to love what you love. But for now, the gloves are off and the hissy fit is on. This week, I'm going to rip his fucking throat out. We're going to talk about Roadhouse. Recommended by me. I actually got to bring one to the table that Will had not seen. I figured it was the new one's coming out here. As a matter of fact, like this week as we're recording, I'm not sure when this episode will drop, but I think we're going to do a twofer where we'll watch the old one here and then we'll watch the new one with Jake and see how it goes. So this is I don't want to say a core tapestry hanging on the museum wall in the mandem of Don, but it's pretty close where, yeah, this one I get to bring to the table. So I'll be crazy for Swayze today as we're recording on St. Patrick's Day. So perfect. Our format is this. The recommending lover goes first. They'll get five uninterrupted minutes to shower their praise and state their high-minded case. The hater follows with five uninterrupted minutes of their own to present their counterpoints with any manner of intellectual scorched earth. After that, we'll open it up for about 30 seconds of shared, or 30 seconds. Ha! Shit! 30 minutes of shared conversation. Get your thoughts through quickly. Where the hissy fit really gets chippy. So, pour the drambuie. Hope you enjoy the smells of nature, and let's go.
Well, yeah, before we get into the time, like, yeah, this is one of those huge blind spots that I had.
That's all right.
It's part of the, I would say it's part of the cultural zeitgeist, the consciousness.
I think so. Yeah.
It's not, but it's far enough away that they can make a remake of it and people won't be all up in arms about it because it's been so long. Also bonus points for being directed by somebody named Rowdy, which is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
But this is one of my pet peeves, and I'm sure some people that might listen to this that I know that have done this, and I'm not much of a conflict person, so unless I really have to be, but I will address this in general. But like, it's impossible to see every movie. So like,
oh gosh,
for all the people that say they're disappointed in me that I didn't see this, well, guess what? I just saw it. It's fine. The world still revolves around. Well, it's fine. It's just, you're not going to see everything, you know? Like, I don't like when people do that, when they'll be like, oh, I know, I didn't see this. It's my first time. Like, yeah. Our friend Michelle did that. She was like, yeah, she watched The Fugitive for the first time. And everyone, she was like, I know, I didn't see it. I haven't seen it. And I'm just like, who cares? Like,
I mean, it's what shelf you go to, what cups of tea you have. Some of it's your age. Like, I mean, let's do the math here. 1989, you were what, seven?
Yes. Seven. Yeah.
Yeah. I was 10 where, a 10-year-old, well, back in the 80s, you can put a 10-year-old in front of this with, dudes and booze and titties and stuff like that. And it was like perfectly fine to entertain your child with this. So, but a 7-year-old, maybe not so much. There might be somebody going, well, maybe not that one. Let's not show, little William that one. Let's let him wait a few years.
So. Well, yeah. So
if you miss it, you miss it. Cause yeah. I think part of this thing that keeps this, part of the thing that has made this be a legacy yet still be faded enough to have a remake is the fact that we just don't have Patrick Swayze anymore. It'd be different if every year on his birthday, the man comes out or he's going to conventions and he's signing posters and like if he was that guy, but he's not. No one from this movie's doing anything with it. Sam Elliott doesn't exactly walk around, pulling his pubes out and stuff like that. So,
well, this is my PSA is no one should be ashamed if you haven't seen a movie. I see people that
goes for rookies and experts because we can be critic. I have blind spots like crazy and I'm supposed to be what I'm supposed to be, So,
right. Yeah. So I just, that's the thing is if you're ever typing on social media, like, oh, I know guys, before you say anything, I haven't seen it. Don't even bother doing that. It doesn't matter. There's stuff that you're never going to see. There's stuff that you're going to see later.
Not that I like write poetry, but there's a poem I've been working on like that. I know this is going to sound grim, but like if I'm ever like my eulogy someday, somebody can read this, and I kind of say this thing, like there'll always be another movie, because like not that I'm going through any kind of chronic disease or anything like that, but like I used to be that person who goes like, all right, I just need to live to see blank, you know, like this summer is like, I need to see, you know, whatever the big movie is of the year. Like, oh my God, please let me just live that long to have $7 to see that movie, you know? And I was completely overdramatic as a 22-year-old saying that, like, I just need to see Superman Returns in 2006, you know, like, cause that kind of dork of a person, you know, where like, I look back and go, wow, those are the things you put, you know, lifelong importance on. So, but I do think about that where it's just, you'll never see everything and there'll always be another movie. So like, just floating the ones you got, you know. I feel like, but I'm also, you know me, I'm a pretty even keel guy where it's hard for me to like get really disappointed, like, oh my God, those are wasted 2 hours. Like I don't go there too often. Some of that is scruples of like making sure I pick something that would challenge me or be interesting, or just I try to find something good in everything I watch. So
sure. Yeah, no, and that's and that being said, you know, I've seen Patrick Swayze is kind of like a little bit of Steve Martin, kind of like Steve Martin for me. Just somebody that I have missed a little bit in the cultural consciousness. Sure. I've seen Point Break, but I saw that very late. I probably watched that for the first time about 2 years ago.
Okay. That's a dandy too. Let me tell you.
And there's two huge ones that I've never seen. And you know, one of them is Ghost. You know, I haven't seen that yet. I haven't seen Dirty Dancing either. I have not seen it. So like, he's kind of a cultural, like I said, I don't think I've ever seen, other than like Father of the Bride or something. I've pretty much missed a lot of those Steve Martin. Patrick Swayze is kind of one of those guys where I've only seen four of his movies.
Okay.
And two of the big ones, Roadhouse and Point Break, I've seen probably in the last 2 years. And Roadhouse I saw 2 days ago. So he's just something I missed. So somebody I missed and wasn't like a draw. Like,
no, I know what you mean.
You know, like he wasn't like somebody where I was just like, man, I hear all this love for Patrick Swayze. I got to go in and watch all of his movies. Like, I just never found that draw. So one was definitely a blind spot, but I'm glad I watched it. And we'll talk about it in our 5 minutes and stuff. But I'm glad I've seen it now. Like it's on it's off the blind spot list.
It does feel good when you get one of those off the list. It does feel good. Sure. I'll start my five. So, I joke with you in situations where it matters and situations where it doesn't. I'm a hashtag crazy for Swayze guy. He must have hit a chord with, and I'm going to say probably my mother, because my mother watched Dirty Dancing, had the soundtrack. You know, she would have been, let's see here, she probably would have been 20, she might have been 36 when this came out. Like, maybe 36, 37 years old. And so when Dirty Dancing came out, and that was like the biggest thing for him. But before that, I remember being, because again, you could do this when it was television. I remember getting sat down in front of like the TV miniseries. Remember like the epic 80s, like, you know, they would have like
the Thornbirds, Lonesome Dove.
Yeah, like those things that would be like, they would last like 6-7 weeks. It mattered. Like everybody in the world was on it. Like it was these massive, big cast, almost Cecil B. DeMille level television things that were like huge, important, like 6-episode. Like we have True Detective now, but like this was prestige TV when the 80s didn't have anything like that. He was in a Civil War one called North and South, which did book one and book two. Like they did 2 years worth of it, in 85 and 86. And they got Patrick Swayze to kind of be the second male lead right after he was hot off of Red Dawn. And then he would just segue that into Dirty Dancing. And then after that, he was just a star. And he was that star that guys could dig because he was just cool. And he wasn't like, you know, completely ripped to shreds. He looked like a guy you can hang with, look like a guy you have a smoke and a drink of beer with, you know, compared to like Stallone and Schwarzenegger, who just seemed a little too larger than life, you know. At the same time, of course, he's a gorgeous man. We're just chicks dig him too. So like, he really was the best of both worlds, where, you know, you can have a Patrick Swayze movie and kind of, you know, check all the boxes in terms of your demographics in like a date night situation, where, you know, a guy's not going to feel stupid watching Dirty Dancing and a girl's not going to feel weird watching Roadhouse. It was just a little bit of everything. So Roadhouse was kind of like, for, you know, kind of going through his history, like his first kind of really big lead spot to kind of be the man, all of his star power clicking on things, and his first kind of big stop being like an action star. And I know it's, you know, in that era where, like, you know, Bruce Willis would come up with Die Hard, and we started to kind of create, you know, action heroes out of things that aren't Stallone and Schwarzenegger, where Kurt Russell's cooking at this time and stuff like that. But like Roadhouse hit where it was just, and again, I was completely too young to watch it, but like, how cool would it be to be like, the coffee drinking, martial arts knowing, get the girl, great hair, bouncer. Like, this was like a year after Cocktail, where Tom Cruise made you want to be the bartender. And then a year later, you know, Patrick Swayze makes you want to be the bouncer, now the bartender, because the bouncer gets to keep people's asses instead of make little drinks. Where, like, you know, it took Tom Cruise and one upped him in a way of like the neon bar setting kind of thing. And now you have the, like, this Porky's level roadhouse situation out in the middle of nowhere in Missouri, where it just looked like, you know, despite how ridiculous the place looks in terms of like breaking chairs and tables and cages around bands, like, it was crazy enough in your head. It was that place, like, I want to go see that place. Can I go to the Double Deuce? Like, and of course you realize in your adult years, like, oh my gosh, no child should ever touch that place. Neither should any clean hands as well. But it just looked like one of those things where just such a different world, and a world that could be right in your backyard. And maybe this is Midwestern me, America, talking, where I know places like that. I know bars that would be on that level, you know, the ones that are just off the highway and weird little country places where, you know, the closest thing you had to this in Animal House was like, you know, do you mind if we dance with your dates? Like, those kinds of clowns of places. But to see Swayze come in with just Captain Cool, the cigarette, the drinks, the martial arts, you know, Kelly Lynch, just the smoke show coming out, It had something for everything. Watching it now, just kind of revisiting, I realize how damn good Ben Gazzara is as the villain, where you've got Swayze doing all the cool things in the world, and then you have just a, you know, enough of a larger than life villain to kind of have a chokehold on this town, but and be cartoonish on one side because of all the gaudy things he has, but at the same time violent enough to do some shit, you know. Because I think today, we always do this on the show where we look at movies then and movies now, but like, today this guy would just be wisecracks and threats, but he's a guy who put a fucking pistol at somebody, or you'd shoot somebody down, or, you know, tortured a hardware store. Like, he had some follow through to the shit he did, and that was fun to watch. But between that, the music, Jeff Healey's the hidden MVP of this movie, Sam Elliott's a blast. It's just damn fun. And it's, I know it probably goes on somebody's checklist as being an extremely misogynistic movie or a very male-centered movie, but I don't know, man. I think Swayze keeps this from being a complete sausage fest in terms of like values and morals and things like that, because he is trying to be the zen cool guy who, you know, does right by the women in the movie, and, you know, and still kind of kicks his ass and takes the names he wants to, where not that this is in great hands with, like you said, a director named Rowdy, but you've got a movie that this could be far worse, and it's probably at this point a comedy. We can go back in this movie and watch, you know, everyone be dead serious in a movie that is ridiculous. But it's a blast. And for me, a formative, like, how cool can cool get? And at least from a, you know, redneck standpoint. And for me, it's Roadhouse. So, dang. I love this movie to pieces. Adore it.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, you know, like I said, first time watch for me. I enjoyed it heavily. I got to say a couple of things about it that are interesting is, and I put in my little mini review on Letterboxd, this kind of feels like everything that the 80s ever did in film, but also feels like a very singular, its own thing as well. It's kind of a really weird movie, because you're kind of watching it going, okay, well, that makes sense. That's 80s. 80s action film, but at the same time it also just kind of functions on this different spectrum that I don't think I've really ever really seen in movies. It just kind of is its own thing, and it's pretty wild. It's kind of got its own, it's almost fantastical. It's almost kind of like, it's kind of got like a little bit of the, you know, the Western style, some of the Clint Eastwood High Plains Drifter feel to it, where it's like the guy who comes from out of town to fix things and then leaves. It's got kind of a fantastical element to it. And in terms of like fantasy, it's almost like this community of Jasper is like this alternate universe where all this stuff happens, because you've got this totally evil, you know, land baron, so to speak, who just kind of runs things. It's very strange. It seems very weird. Plus like the way the town is run, and the, I don't know, just it all feels so very weird, like, so just very of its own piece. Like, Roadhouse is just its own thing, despite maybe all the 80s influences you can see in it. So it's kind of one foot in both worlds. And this is probably influenced by the fact that I just watched a documentary about how the FBI tried to suppress It's a Wonderful Life for being communist. This movie's kind of communist when you think about it, or at least socialist. And I'm not intelligent enough to really break that down, but I was just kind of thinking like, oh, this is the this is down with the capitalist pig, and the town belongs to all kind of thing. But no, in a serious note, enjoyable motion picture. I really enjoyed Patrick Swayze. I kind of like that he's got his like moral code that he lives by, but he also, just has like a go-to killing move, which I think is pretty interesting. There's a lot of moments. I put a screenshot of it on our Instagram page where he's about to rip somebody's throat out. And it's just kind of like, that's like his move. It's like his go-to move. Like if they made an action figure of him, his hand, it'd be like one of those interchangeable hand things where like one, it would be a fist so you could take the hand off, and one would be the little iron claw motion that he's making about to rip someone's throat out. There's really not much I can say other than it's an enjoyable experience. You do have to experience it. I think it's both of its time and timeless. In terms of the cast, excellent cast of really great character actors, background extras. They must have pulled every single woman who takes place or who participates in wet t-shirt contest to be in this movie, including Julie Michaels, who is known for being in a lot of stuff, including Jason Goes to Hell, in which she takes a shower for 45 minutes before she gets killed in the opening scene. There's some 80s hot ladies in this. I say 80s hot because these kind of hairstyles and things don't exactly flow. Kelly Lynch is okay. She's not great. Sam Elliott is fantastic. I actually went into this movie thinking Sam Elliott, because I didn't know anything really about it. And anytime I saw pictures, I would see, Sam Elliott kind of in a serious mode. I kind of thought he was the villain. So when I sat down to watch this and found out he's kind of like the wizened old man guide to Patrick Swayze, I was happy, because I actually didn't want to see Sam Elliott go up against Patrick Swayze. I wanted to see them take out Ben Gazzara, who's also really excellent in this. It's just a great great ensemble. It's got, like I said, it's got the Western setting to it, template, but it also has a lot of the action tropes. I mean, there's at least two or three buildings exploding. There's a car exploding. There's shootouts. There's karate fights. There's all kinds of shit going on in this movie. It's packed. And I would be remiss before my time ends up that it's also shot by Dean Cundey, who is the man. So that's the end of my 5 minutes.
All right, hang tight, folks, and please enjoy this short announcement from the Ruminations Radio Network.
What's up, gang? This is Hoptimus. You've been listening to one of the great new podcasts from Ruminations Radio Network. If you want some more tasty sound vibes, come check out my new podcast, The Retro Futurist Culture, where we talk about alternate timelines, cyberpunk, anime, and other crazy worlds. If that does not strike your fancy, we have plenty of other great shows at ruminationsradionetwork.com.
All right, welcome back. No, I think you're nailing the head in it with the idea of like, this was kind of, at least on paper, made to kind of, like you said, be much of Western. A white hat comes into town to try to spare the civilians from things. Not that exactly Seven Samurai, but like you said, High Plains Drifters, things like that, where that tone is there for sure. And that's probably why it is like I love what you said, where it's like its own thing, because obviously it's got that Western framework, but of course it's not a Western. We're in bars, with no guns and things like that. But at the same time, you have the 80s-ness of things, but there's not like a signature trope. Like, yeah, cocaine's here a little bit, beards here a little bit, but it's not, all the way through it. You have, the white blues guy doing the music instead of something of the 80s where it's not a techno band. It's got a lot of little edges of this and little edges of that, and all of them are probably ruffled and frayed for the 80s, or at least sprayed with Aquanet. And I like the, you're right, it is completely a time capsule of the 80s, but you can pull it out today and not have it be as, covered in mothballs as it could be. And I'm with you on the Western thing in one more way, where it's just that idea of it's a simple Obviously, it's an up and down, drama of this, mano a mano stuff in a town, but all that. But it's not like, maybe because there's no police presence or media presence, that it's just these little happenings that happen in this little place versus like Die Hard, where the cops show up or the FBI shows up or it's on the news. And it's not made to be too big. It's just, a little town misadventure where two towns over, no one's even heard what's going on,
A better comp, actually, I was going with the Clint Eastwood, because Clint Eastwood had two or three of these bordering on supernatural guy comes into town. A better comp would actually be Pale Rider than High Plains Drifter. Because High Plains Drifter, he's a bad person that's reincarnated, essentially, and comes in to wipe out the town, but it's like revenge purposes only, whereas Pale Rider,
that's the one.
He's essentially like a cowboy Jesus who comes in to save the town from the evil mining company that's plundering everything from the people in town. So it's actually, I would say that's a better comp, just to correct myself from the comparison. This kind of has that, this is that kind of noble warrior, guy who lives by his code, is undefeatable, essentially. He never loses. Sometimes the philosophies get a little screwed up, because
get a little muddy. Yeah.
at one point when he's in the when he meets the doctor, Kelly Lynch, for the first time,
right?
He says something like, "Hey, do you win all your fights?" And he says, "No one wins when you fight."
That's right.
But then, like towards the end of the movie, he's like, "I never lose. I'm gonna win every fight." It was like, okay, well, that's weird. Like I said, the philosophies are a little weird. He's kind of got like these. It's strange, because he'll go into the Schwarzenegger and Stallone one-linerism, like, pain don't hurt, you're too stupid to have fun or whatever. But then, like, he'll philosophize and then do Tai Chi outside for 45 minutes. It's like, it's a very strange character. And I think that's why it's kind of endearing, because you can never tell if this guy is like, what are those charts people put out where it's like, your chaotic evil, neutral good,
the old Dungeons and Dragons alignment chart, right? What would he be like?
He'd be lawful, chaotic good.
A chaotic good, because he's killed a man. Like, that's kind of the myth of this guy, is like everybody know. Like, oh my god, it's Dalton! Like, he's got first name basis, pre-internet to just roll around where he's going, and all that. Mm-hmm. But and obviously the story goes around that he's killed somebody, like where he was at gunpoint, and it was one of those, like, and Sam Elliott describes it, where like, you either drop the motherfucker or you get shot, So, I mean, he obviously has that chaotic edge, and he's going to rip a motherfucker's throat if he needs to. So, I wonder I would try to do like chaotic neutral, lawful neutral, if I'm playing the D&D, dice and alignment thing, but he's a tricky one. You're right.
Yeah, he's just kind of hard to read.
Smoking cigarettes, he's still,
I think and the romance is a little weird, because it's the 80s romance where, like, people see each other and they're immediately going to just start banging, like, the next time.
You're hot, I'm hot.
Yeah.
You're the only hot person around, I'm the only hot person around. Let's fuck, it doesn't take much. Yeah.
Here's the thing, though.
They waited two dates,
I'm not a I don't necessarily want to be a body shame person, but
sure.
Kelly Lynch, not the greatest boob job I've ever seen.
That's the 80s talking back at it. Yeah, you betcha. Yeah.
Uh-huh. But there is a lot of boobs in this movie, though. Yes, but at the same time, you go to your basement to watch movies. Like, I'm in the living room.
Good point.
If I hear my daughter coming out of the hallway, I'm just like, should I pause this right now? I'm not sure. Right. Like, or should I just let it play, or should I just turn it off? Because there's all kinds of great. There's what is it? It's not a wet t-shirt concert. It's a wet G-string concert, which I don't even think it makes sense.
No, because the shirt's already off. Yeah, and that's Sam Elliott just hanging out. Yeah,
there is a full sex scene of. They're implying that the girl is very underage, and this guy is just like, "You're my Saturday thing."
In the storeroom, Swayze and Lynch have a hot scene, and then Julie Michaels does that great stage striptease. I mean, there's a good bit.
Not only does Kelly Lynch, not only do they have the scene inside the house, but then I gotta give props to the villain, who obviously has a thing for her. To sit there and watch while your crush just like rides this dude on a barn roof. You're getting some stuff in your head at that point. You're just like, man, this guy's really effed up. I would
Discuss,
but
well, I mean, it that also goes to the weirdness of the movie, where I think this was shot like in California. Like this didn't
touch
Missouri, you know? So well,
there's Rocky Mountains everywhere. Yeah. So, yeah.
But like, you have Swayze who's doing the whole, just come into town, get, you know, borrow a crappy car. So he doesn't have to use his nice car, stay in a room for rent, 'cause he's not going to be there long. And of course it's a barn, you know, it's a, by the way, the most gorgeous barn apartment possible, despite the smells of nature, but like, oh my gosh, a nice kitchen, great living room, incredible view. But across the river is the most decadent, you know, 80s mansion since Dallas with this Ben Gazzara villain and with Brad Wesley. That's right. But the fact that they're like across the river from each other, and they know they're across the river from each other, and having all these little like entanglements and confrontations where like it is just such a weird thing that this guy doing his little outdoor Tai Chi is across the way from the guy who has the topless pool parties and stuff. It's just weird. It is just downright weird. You know, his Gazzara is just weird and rich enough to be eccentric, but not also, but you know, but then not over the top. Like he's Chicago mafia money somewhere there a little bit, but like of all the places, he comes to Missouri to do his thing. And I don't know, it works enough, you know.
I wish they leaned into his insane richness a little bit more, because by the end of the movie, when you're in that trophy room, which is insane, like there's like 900 like dead animals in that thing.
He raided a Bass Pro Shops for sure to get all that.
I wish they did into that. But also the other problem with the character now. Here's where it gets to the predictable 80s part.
With Brad Wesley, you're saying?
Yes, with Brad Wesley.
Okay, go ahead.
This is the part I didn't like, and I knew this was going to come, because when I was sitting in the movie, I was like, okay, this guy is obviously a rich prick, but he harasses the town folks for money, protection money, whatever. But like, he seems more like a nuisance. So like, in order for him to become a true villain, like he's got to step up his game into like outright fucking like murder in public.
Right.
And I called that about 5 minutes in, or when you first met him in the helicopter, you're like, oh, that guy's annoying.
Yeah.
But then I was like, okay, something's going to happen for this to escalate to the point where Patrick Swayze is going to have to kill him. Like, cause
right.
Just being an annoying prick is one thing. But he'll have to do something, and I figured it was going to be someone was going to get killed that was close to him. I still am kind of surprised with the way Sam Elliott went out. I'm not surprised that he died,
because
I feel like it was necessary for the plot to.
I think so too. Are we missing a good death scene though? To just have him show up in the bar dead.
I would see. Here's the thing: I love that character so much. I wouldn't want to see him dead. I wouldn't want to see him die. It would be too sad. But then at the same time, that might help the drama.
Sure.
But it does seem kind of weird, because they do kind of push him up, propel him as this like almost like this unbeatable guy also.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And then you're supposed to believe that suddenly he just got stabbed out of nowhere and just placed in the bar. You know, it's just kind of a weird thing. But there's all kinds of stuff going on in this movie. And I think like I said, it's stupid. In the sense that the villain has to become more than what he's probably capable of in order to progress the plot. I mean, once you're getting to, which doesn't make any sense, once you're getting to the Bigfoot scene.
Yeah, with the car dealership.
The car dealership, you're kind of like, okay, now we're into 80s excess territory right now.
Yeah.
It wouldn't make sense if you want to have someone under your thumb.
Destroy their business,
paying you money, destroy all their business. Makes no sense.
Blow up the hardware store. How are you going to get money from the hardware store if you blow it up? You know? It's kind of like, you got over the edge there.
It's a little weird. And like I said, he starts ramping up the psychotic like killing. I also at no point there's one line they always do this in movies. The most notable example to me is Gladiator, when, you know, the only way that you can justifiably have Joaquin Phoenix fight Russell Crowe in that movie is if Joaquin Phoenix like stabs him in the lung or something like right before the fight. There's like a moment where he's wounded Patrick Swayze somehow. And at one point he's like, I really wanted to fight you. And I was just like, dude, there's no freaking way. You've seen him go through your goons like eight times. Like, there's no way you would have fought that guy. Like, there's just no way. So that was a little stretching credulity a little bit.
Yeah. And then like that villain is like Johnny or something like that, where he's pole vaulting with pole cues and stuff like that. Like that's again, like where does Brad Wesley get that guy, and what is he for? Like, you know, is he like,
that's the odd managerial job.
Training program? Yeah, he is very much odd job, but like, I used to fuck guys like you in prison. Like, whoa, okay. We're going there, huh? You know, like that's what a hell of a line to stay in a fight, you know? And, but I mean, there goes, but again, like this movie, like because of stuff like that and the fight scenes and like the everyone did their own stunts. I learned in this movie where everyone's out there really taking their shit and to see those guys go mano a mano. And then, like you said, Dean Cundey, like shooting this thing to look like a zillion fucking bucks. Like the neon glows, the shots are great, good pans, you know, good shots to, you know, to kind of capture things at distances. And then to cut that fight scene together, you know, you got your diehard almost Michael Kamen music coming on, you know, like it gets exciting when you need it to get exciting. You know,
there's some retreads of some Lethal Weapon cues in there that Michael Kamen did.
Yeah,
as well,
I hear that. But, that's the thing I'm thinking. Yeah.
But, and I don't know if it's because I've seen 20 Dean Cundey shot films, and you know, he's kind of become a victim of the, you know, the CGI age where, you know, he's only doing the Jack and Jills and the Garfield movie stuff now. But, you know, he used to be pretty dynamic and used to do all these really high class, but just, you know, the Back to the Future, The Thing, Halloween, Hook, Escape from New York, all that stuff. Big Trouble, Little China, Apollo 13, kind of these prestigious things. And I don't know if it's because I've seen so many of his films that I kind of like, I can kind of tell when it's a Dean Cundey film.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of tell, there's just something about the way he shoots movies. They have a look. I would almost say it's almost Roger Deakins-y in a sense. Because like Roger, when you watch Roger Deakins shot thing, even if you don't know it's him, you can kind of be like, hey, that's a Roger
Deakins. The magic hour in the backlight, you know, like it, you're going to get one of those shots every movie, whether it's the assassination of the coward, you know, from Westerns to Sicario, like you get a magic hour backlit shot every time, you know,
that's, it's kind of
Deakins, you know,
to me, weird.
For Cundey, is it the slickness of the moon of night? You know, like there is an edge to there's a sheen to it. I know what
it's
you're saying.
It's also something about the way he shoots people. Like it just, it's just like, I don't know. It's something about the, maybe the lenses he uses, like the grain.
Okay.
It's just like when I watch, like, this is a weird, I'm going to do weird comps all over the place, but
I love it. That's like, the signature of the show.
Like when I was watching this, I was like, oh yeah, this is Dean Cundey, because this looks like Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Like it looked the same as that.
Yeah. Okay.
Versus some of the more coverage shots in like Back to the Future. Jurassic Park is pretty polished for him. I think that's
the Spielberg once over that comes after Dean Cundey's done, you know?
Yeah. But another super weird comp is, and this is a McCundy thing, but like, I guess it depends on how, like, I'm not a drummer, right? But like, there's two or three drummers that I can tell they're drumming, right? That's a very hard thing to do in a position in music in which you're just kind of there to get the beat going. So there's like two or three guys that I can, if I hear them on a guest appearance somewhere else, I'll be like, oh, you got Dave Grohl to do the drums for that. Oh, you got Brain Daler, or you got Lars Ulrich, whatever. Like Cundey's like that for cinematographers. Like I feel like there's two or three guys where you can kind of tell it to them. And I think it's hard to do in film because it's not something that I think the average film goer pays attention to, but also
I agree.
There's only so many ways to shoot a film, so
it's going to come up. Right.
They're going to, you know, it's certain styles come across a certain way. And I think Cundey's one of those guys where like, I was enjoying the movie more because I was just like, oh, I'm going to see this guy cook.
Yeah.
You know, while I was watching, because once it popped up, I kind of had a feeling, but once it popped up, I was like, oh, okay, let's see how this goes. And just, it's a great looking movie. Like I was kind of surprised. I thought it was going to be something, I don't know, just because of the subject matter or how much I've heard about it, I thought it was going to be something that was a little run down and cheap. This is a really good looking movie.
Better looking than it has any business looking like, you know, compared compared to its brethren, you know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is a great looking movie, but yeah, I got a lot of his Carpenter vibes from this.
Sure.
And especially like The Fog, Halloween 3, well, Halloween 3 is a Carpenter, but you know what I mean? It's just kind of has that, that look, and it's kind of a great, and I hear he's still active too, which is great.
I think he's still going. I think the next part of this movie that I enjoy, and maybe this is the every movie has a lesson part of me coming out, is, the Zen stuff that comes from Swayze, like his, like, you know, opening first day of school speech, you know, when he's like, you know, giving out the rules to the bouncers, and obviously, you know, before he's cleaning the place up, and like that whole speech can just go in movie Hall of Fame of like, you know, he's got the folded arms, he's got the tucked in shirt, you know, it's 80s, but what he's saying, how he's saying it, the camera loves him, he's right on him, laser focused with his eyes, busting out guys, you know, is he, what if they call my mom a whore? Is she, you know, like just every the lines he's given to cook with and just carry that scene from a screen presence standpoint. You're just watching him, you know, after all the like two lines before this is like, I thought you'd be bigger. You're like, all that stuff has already come out, but now here he comes standing two steps up, controlling the room, and just, you know, and then you expect it to be tough talk the way he's talking about it, but then he gets, you know, be nice, you know, and he goes right. Well, like, to have that be the crescendo, which is preposterously silly, but at the same time, it works.
Well, it is
because, coming out of his mouth, you know,
it is because. Talk about the muddying of the waters. It's like, just be nice, you know. Yeah, and at one point, he like sends three of the guys to go fight someone, and then it doesn't work out. And he's like, hey, just be nice. And then, of course, the guy comes over, Patrick Swayze beats the living shit out of him.
Oh yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
You're just like, well, wait a minute. You just said to be nice, and you let the other guys get their shit kicked out of them. But
it's time not to be nice. Yeah. It is a little inconsistent. Like, hey man, you're like, I can use help over here. You know, hey, fix it, buddy. You know. Hate to be a trainee in the program for sure.
Yeah, no kidding. But you know, like you're saying though, not only does it look better than it has any right to be, and I know you said in your 5 minutes that you know, it can be silly because they're taking it very seriously, but I think it avoids. There's, you know, you can watch some Stallone stuff, you can watch some Schwarzenegger stuff, even other big
Willis movies too. Yeah,
Willis. Where it just doesn't, it's maybe because they were just doing it for the paycheck, or maybe because they were tired because it was the same movie for six times in a row. I think the sincerity of the performances here,
I agree,
keeps it from being kind of a joke, even though it is silly. Yeah. You're never in doubt. Like, everyone's given 100%. Like, there's never
especially
a moment.
Swayze, you know, who's just, this is Shakespeare for him, you know, to get up here and deliver these lines and be stern and be a tortured hero. Like, oh no, he's going 110%.
Yeah, and I think that helps it not become kind of a silly joke. Because I mean, it is silly, but it never feels foolish. Like I'm never sitting there like laughing at it. You know what I mean? Right. Like,
and
so that's kind of a bonus.
I think that still goes back to Swayze as well, being just, I mean, he's still impossibly good looking enough where you can't call him an everyman, you know. But at the same time, he still can play. Being a slighter man and being a dancer, being a graceful person, and can be vulnerable in terms of the way his emotions play out with his, just the way he carries himself as a character. We wouldn't have that kind of bond or connection or even sympathy or even rooting interest if this was a larger life action hero that you completely predict to win. You know, again, if this was Stallone or Schwarzenegger, he'd be like, okay, it's just a buffet line of watching people get their ass kicked. Just no doubt fights. And even if, you know, Patrick Swayze and the good guy is going to win, like, he still goes through some shit. I mean, he maybe medically doesn't show it, like in the fight with Johnny, you know, like the throat rip fight, you know, like the next scene, he's like, doesn't have a scratch on him. even though in that actual fight, Marshall Teague is the actor who plays Johnny, and Patrick Swayze, like, they like really went at it with, like, you know, throw real punches and real kicks, where by the end of that fight, Swayze's covered in bruises, two broken ribs, and a busted knee. And it was that busted knee that he hurt while filming this movie that kept him from what he turned down, playing Cash in Tango and Cash. And he turned down the Mike Harrigan part in Predator 2, and he ended up making Ghost because he knew that movie wouldn't be hard on his knee. And then sure enough, look at that, be his biggest hit of his career. So I can thank Roadhouse for Ghost.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. I also can thank.
You can thank Roadhouse for Tango and Cash.
Well, no, I can thank Roadhouse hurting him so I can get Danny Glover in.
There you go. That's the thing. I can't imagine Swayze doing the grizzled, I'm tooling for this shit cop thing in Predator 2, you know. Or he's just also a small guy who get his ass kicked, you know, by the Predator. So. I'm glad it was Glover, you know, for LA. Because that's the other thing. Swayze just, maybe this between Red Dawn and Patrick and Dirty Dancing, where, like, he's not a, and I know Ghost turns him into a New Yorker, but, like, he's just not a city guy. He's, you know.
He doesn't feel like a.
Like a 20-year-in cop, you know, or a 10-year-in cop. Versus, like, when he's the surfer in Point Break, like, that's more believable. Somebody on the fringe of society and not, like, rooted into everything, you know.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good take. Because I will say that one of the parts of the movie that doesn't really fit that well is the opening where he's clearly like in what, Miami or something. It's something.
Yeah.
He's in kind of that big city, big lifestyle. Like
bigger place. Yeah.
And he doesn't totally fit there like as much as he does when he goes to Missouri. You know, like it just seems like Missouri feels like a better fit. Like I couldn't imagine seeing him be the tough guy in a Miami or a
I agree. Yeah.
Or Atlanta. I don't know, wherever the hell they were. But
or if he was, he would need to be like if he was the Don Johnson part in like Miami Vice, I could see it. You know, because the cigarette, the grizzledness, you know, like if he wanted to do that, he could, but he'd be covered in a suit. He'd have an extra guy with him. But for this, it's just different. Yeah.
It works. Yeah. Just, that's the only part that's kind of like, just seems a little out of place. But I mean, we're picking at nits here. I think overall, it's just a really fun movie. I'm glad, like I said, I'm glad I finally watched it because I can just kind of appreciate why it gets so much love. I am actually interested now. I wasn't interested really to watch the. I like Jake Gyllenhaal a lot.
Same.
But I wasn't like
rushing out the door.
See the new one, but now I'd like to actually because I'm separated from.
Right, you're not married to this one.
Yeah, I think maybe because I'm separated from the decades of reverence slash, you know, cultural relevance that it has.
Yeah.
And I'm not connected to it in that way that maybe I can look at this redo with open eyes, objective eyes, whatever. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying, what do you feel? Do you think how do you feel about a remake of this?
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm that Lisa Simpson meme that says, hey, we should remake bad movies to give them another chance rather than good movies that don't need help. You know, I'll still be that Lisa Simpson meme that we see all the time. But at the same time, I'm trying to be open-minded. I'm trying not to tell myself to waste time where I'm open for it. It's been enough years where, you know what, Jake, and Jake is ripped enough where he's kind of that guy. I'm not saying he's a modern Sweezy because I don't think he's a modern Sweezy whatsoever. But like the fact that Jake can also be a person who is guys like and girls like, you know, if there's a universal appeal guy about the right age and a guy who could convincingly be a tough guy, it is Jake Gyllenhaal. And he's clearly like got himself in UFC fighting shape to be that, be that origin story of this movie. I feel like just because of the trailer that kind of shows the origins of where Gyllenhaal's version of Dalton comes from, you know, the UFC stuff and how they're going to have that in, you know, part of the movie where that's kind of one of the fun things about Roadhouse almost with your Western and fantasy vibe is like, this guy could have walked out of the corner in Iowa just to be a bouncer, you know, like we don't know. We have this whispered origin of killing a man in Memphis or something like that. But like, we don't know a damn thing about Dalton other than that he has a nice car, that he obviously takes care of his money, does these bouncing jobs enough to be, you know, a Reddit level popular.
Renowned.
But like, he's not like, cause Jake Gyllenhaal is going to get to this movie and like, he's going to be recognized because of TV and screen, like, hey, aren't you that UFC guy that I saw at pay-per-view last weekend? Like, it's going to be almost immediately overexposed. Now, what I am ready for in the new movie is if Conor McGregor is the heavy, just because of his loquaciousness as a fighter and just the the larger than life personality he is, and then the skill set, he could be. I mean, he's been ready for me for movies for a long time. Like, where he doesn't have to be Dwayne Johnson and John Cena, but Conor McGregor can just come in and be just a heavy, like it sounds like he's going to be in this one, and then someday, you know, cachet that to be a, you know, WWE wrestler, you know, because that's probably where ex-UFC guys can go, like Ronda Rousey did, like Brock Lesnar did, even though Brock got to start wrestling, went to UFC, came back, whatever. But like Conor McGregor's born for, like, get a bigger camera on that guy and let him do something cool. So I'm ready for Conor McGregor as much as I'm ready for Jake Gyllenhaal.
Well, is he going to, like, is there going to be a Brad Wesley character and he's like the odd job, or that's, is he going to be the Brad Wesley?
You're gonna make me look it up. I mean, you know me, I'm trying not to. I'm seeing it tomorrow. I think, or at least that Amazon has promised me a screener tomorrow. I'll come through Amazon. The new Roadhouse has, let's see if I can whittle this down. It's Doug Liman, who is, you know, a legit action director, where it's gonna look good, it's gonna move good. Mm-hmm. It looks like Jake Gyllenhaal is Dalton, Conor McGregor is Knox. Is there another, Joaquin de Alameda, who is, you know, we love him just for his voice alone. He's the sheriff, Billy Magnuson. I don't see a like old guy third co-star here. Maybe he's the Brad Wesley. Okay.
For some reason, I haven't watched a trailer, but you have, which is weird. But,
I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to, let me see.
I watched whatever the short one was, because there's a long trailer and there's like a minute long teaser from 6 months ago. I saw the short one.
It was like
the UFC tease and then like one quick little fight snippet in like, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal Roadhouse. And that's all it went to. So
it looks pretty interesting. I mean, yeah, Doug Liman, I don't mind him, but I guess the point is you don't, you're not so beholden to it. You know,
I mean, maybe you got, I mean, as much as I love Roadhouse, yeah, like I'm trying to think, like I'm sitting on and said, I'll watch anything and find the positive in it. Would I say the same thing if it was Casablanca? Would I say the same thing if it was Ghost? Would I say the same thing if it was something I truly like, Rudy or Field of Dreams? Like, I don't know, you know. I think I can handle any remake of anything, because unlike other people who are just so narrow-minded with this whole thing, like new ones don't erase old ones. You can still pick up Roadhouse off the shelf. I got a nice Shout Select DVD Blu-ray of it, where it's just a gorgeous set, you know? So yeah, like I will never be the person that hates on remakes because they don't erase the previous ones before. If you want to watch the previous one before, pick that one off the shelf and watch it. I don't know why there's this culture of you're replacing things I love. Last time I checked, you can still pull this off the shelf.
Well, I think it depends too on the motivations behind it, you know?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, the one that comes into my mind is something that is famous, a movie that's famous, but had a remake with big stars in it. And no one was upset. And it was The Manchurian Candidate. I think Jonathan Demme did it.
That's a Stone Cold classic on many levels. And to see Demme come in. Yeah.
But it wasn't like, it's not so much of a classic that people were just like, how could you touch this?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and so I kind of think of this on this level too. It's separated enough. Cause I think Manchurian Candidate was 62 and that remake was like 2004 or something. So it's not like,
I think the story or the root, can it be updated in a way that you're honoring it, but you're doing something new? Because like for Manchurian Candidate, the brainwashed political asset thing can be done in the 60s and can be done now. Could shift the politics, change the setting, color it up. And like, obviously you have a guy like Denzel come in and that helps a ton. That can play in any era. You just have to give it some tweaks. Can the really good guy who could fight people come in and be a bouncer? Do we still have bouncers nowadays? Wouldn't that be social media? Isn't that an HR department of problems of lawsuits? I don't know how you would have a bouncer today. So maybe this one's going to be stretching.
You're living, you live in Chicago.
I do.
That's one of the stories going around right now. Have you heard about this, right?
What are we talking about?
The girl went viral on TikTok saying that this place in downtown Chicago, the bouncers, they said, threw her down two things of stairs, roughed her up, grabbed her by the arm, forced her out, threw her down the stairs, et cetera, et cetera. And then the place came out after it went viral and after, all their reviews on Yelp were bad and people were banning it or whatever. And they released the videos and it clearly shows that did not happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean,
it's a different age.
Bouncers have that, they have that, reputation. Like I said, it's a nightmare now, probably for lawsuits, you know?
Yeah. I tell you what, a remake, and I'm always hoping for the chance that a remake can improve on the original or be its own thing enough to be fun. The number one that always works for me is the Thomas Crown Affair, where Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway made a really cool heist movie in the 60s with the multi-screen. It's very 60s, you know, the Michel Legrand music, the multi-screen images, trying to do the photo mosaic thing. Like, that was a 60s trope for sure. And it's like bank robbery where McQueen like hires a team, but kind of helps a little bit, where he's not really hands-on in the whole thing. And obviously the Faye Dunaway chess scene that everyone makes famous, like it's kishy in its own little way. And then in 1999, Pierce Brosnan comes in 30 years later and makes a remake where he's an art thief. And so
McTiernan, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And McTiernan's in there, who's again, like almost like this movie, like just super polished, better looking than it ever has any right to look kind of movie. And, they just switch from bank to art, put the, you know, and it's Brosnan. So you like, he could be a hands-on thief instead of a mastermind. And then you can put a little 90s sex into it a little bit, where you can have a torrid sex scene, which you couldn't do in 68. And then just be fun after that. And, that movie's great, where the remake might be better than the original, or at least it stands on its own, where like by name alone, they're the same, but both are enjoyable experiences of their own. So I think that's my rooting interest for The Roadhouse, is like, if you want to borrow the Dalton thing and do the Zen, like if you have his code come in and, you know, be a whatever fighter he is and whatever like Zen guy, maybe he can be, if you want to translate that to, yeah, the TikTok generation of CD Miami or wherever they're going to be, shift the settings, shift the focus, put an origin to it, I guess, and you can still have Roadhouse for different things. So,
yeah, it does seem pretty. I mean, I use those two examples, Clint Eastwood doing the same movie twice, essentially. Roadhouse seems like something that's pretty flexible to change things up.
But like,
you can, you know.
Well, here, the example that people always bring up is like the reason why things like classics shouldn't be remade is always that Gus Van Sant Psycho one, where I think if Gus didn't make a shot for shot remake, I think if he did Psycho for a modern era, you know, where you take the story Psycho, but you do your own thing, do it in color, do some blood, set it in the 90s and not, you know, and like really go after something different while still calling it Psycho, you probably would have had a better movie than trying to shot for shot it. So, yeah, I get the stylistic experiment to try, but you know, I think you're always better off doing your own thing, or just keep it fresh some way somehow. So I don't know how to, put that in better words, but yeah.
No, I get you. Yeah, so I don't know. I'm not. Well, it seems like someone who's been a fan of it since you were 10. You don't.
I
mind.
Have. Yeah.
I don't care. I don't mind.
I don't. Yeah. Is there? Well, is there a deal breaker movie for you that please don't ever touch it? Please don't ever remake it.
You know what? I used to have that, but I've decided against it. So my big thing,
I was there too.
My thing was, you know, Halloween. I was like, never remake it. Don't touch a classic. And I'm a Rob Zombie fan. He's one of my all time favorite directors. And I would, for probably 10, 12 years, I refused to watch it because of that code that I had. I was like, no, I can't watch the remake. Then I watched it, and it's not great. It's not a great remake, but there was things that went into it, as usual, Weinstein stuff, where you know, he wanted to make his own movie, you know, that explored more like the background of what Michael Myers is and where he came from.
Right.
And they let him shoot that for the first 45 minutes, and then they said, okay, well, now you got to do a direct remake. So it's a direct remake in the last 45 minutes, but then it's a remake of a 90-minute film in 45 minutes on top of all this other stuff he put in. It's very jarring and crazy and weird, and that's a lot of studio interference. And, you know, Rob Zombie himself was just like, I didn't even want to make movies anymore after that. But then they realized, okay, you know, this isn't, you know, if we had just kept our hands off, we probably would have had something a little bit more unique and different. Plus it made money. So they let him have full creative control with the second one. So, and I love the second one, Rob Zombie's second one. It's insane. And so I wouldn't have been able to see one of my favorite Rob Zombie films if I didn't. I would have been able to see it earlier, I guess I should say.
Okay.
If I didn't have this weird, you know, oh no, you can't make a remake and I won't watch it. So I learned my lesson with that. Like, will I be cautious if it's something that I really, really love? You know,
Cautious is fair no matter what. So
But I don't think it's right. And I'm not saying this on some kind of moral standard. I'm just saying for my own personal taste, I don't think it's right to just outright say, I'm not going to watch that and judge it before you even see it.
That's true.
Because you and I,
you meet a lot of people who do that for sure.
Yeah. We know some people that do that where they're just like, oh yeah, this sucks. This movie's terrible. Look at the box office.
Principles.
And then we're like, well, why don't we watch it first? So I'm going to say cautious.
Yeah.
But there's no, I mean, they already redid Halloween and I've seen characters I love be recast. I mean, I've seen Captain Kirk be recast. I've seen Spider-Man be recast. I've seen, you know, stuff like that. So it's not so precious to me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If it ends up being something that I enjoy, Then great. If I end up not liking it, at least, like you said, I have the old one.
Yeah, exactly.
To go back to, it doesn't take it away.
Exactly.
And you know, you and me and a lot of film critics and people that take films seriously and stuff, we do kind of suffer under the problem of kind of knowing how the sausage is made too.
That's true. Yeah.
So, but I guarantee you there's people out there that like, when I posted on Facebook that I was watching the old Roadhouse,
right.
There were some people that are like, well, I haven't seen the original, but I'm excited for the remake. Like they could care less. Like they don't care that they don't know if it's
this removed and yeah.
Like, yeah. But they're not sitting there thinking it's like, oh, this is an IP to be mined they're just like, hey, if it looks good, we're going to watch it. Like, I sometimes want to put myself in that spot. I've been trying to do that a little bit more this year. Cause I think, and we're going to go into this a little bit. Next episode we're recording, but yeah, just the state of film criticism in general has kind of soured me on films in a lot of ways. And I kind of miss just enjoying movies as opposed to,
right,
you know, dealing with all the other stuff. So
All
in all, remake wise, I have no problem with this being remade. I enjoy the first one. I will always enjoy the first one. And if I like the second one, I'm going to like it. And if I don't,
And that's the fun part is like, if I get a second one and I like it, now my love has been multiplied and that's good enough for me, you know?
Well, okay. And then here's where I will draw the line though.
Oh, here it
comes. Yeah. Now this, cause I was looking this up. Every time I watch a movie, especially something I haven't seen,
okay,
it's kind of culturally significant or whatever. I look up, you know, just the history of it, just to get some information. And I did learn that there was a Roadhouse 2.
Oh, yes.
that involves Patrick Swayze's son.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
That is one of what, I mean, that's where I'll draw the line. I'm not going to watch
Starship Troopers 4. That's kind of like stuff like that.
Yeah. If it's a
you have to discount that stuff out of the equation.
Yeah. So that's where I will.
Sure.
On really bad direct-to-video sequels. I will not watch those. So I'm not going to be a complete. So I'll be upfront with that. I have no intention of ever watching Roadhouse 2: Last Call.
Right.
That is, you know, something I will stand ground on. If that makes me ignorant, fine. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure 99.9% of people out there.
I agree. Yeah.
Are not going to watch it either. No.
Until the new one, we can close this one out here.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, follow us. Oh, I'm sorry. I need to pimp ourselves. My bad. Folks.
Ooh, yeah, sure.
We now have merch from shirts to stickers. Find some sweet cinephile hissy fit swag on tpublic.com/user/ruminationsradionetwork.com. Something must be happening in the algorithm out there because I'm getting ads for buying my own shirts. So it's on my Instagram. So it's kind of cool.
That's
Follow us on Twitter at Cinephile Fit, on Facebook at Cinephile His Fit Podcast, and Instagram at Cinephile Fits. Find both of us by name on Letterboxd to check out our film reviews and ratings. We are also on Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you so much for your loyal listenership and our tussles and for connecting with us on social media. Cinephile Hissy Fit is a Ruminations Radio Network podcast sponsored by Film Obsessive. If you enjoyed this show, the Ruminations Radio Network has more excellent programming with stellar hosts and spirited topics. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our show and others on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your favorite podcasts.